Thursday, February 1st, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca, and you might notice some audio differences today. I'm fleeing the normal recording studio. I cannot get away from incessant and, well, it's a little bit of banging, but the construction around here and right to the next to me, well, rather than me talking about it now, as it's abated some, let me play you this section of tape that I recorded a couple of hours ago, just so you get a flavor of what's going on in Gist World Headquarters. Here's that. From Peachfish Productions, it's drilling next door. Months and months of drilling. Do you want to listen to a podcast that sounds like this? I don't. Would have to be pretty great content to overcome the drilling next door. You know, what I do when I record the show is I have this little tiny mini fridge. It holds 4 cans of beverage, and I unplug it because there is a slight hum that's discernible in the background. I guess with this drilling, I won't have to unplug the mini fridge. Right now, my wife, the director of special projects for Peachfish Production, has walked into the studio. Probably you heard, but maybe you didn't. She reached into a bowl that I have gum, and you could hear the clinkling, or you could if there weren't this earth-shattering noise inches from my face. So now I can safely say that that noise, that pounding, is gone, but there's still little moments of disruptive sonic interference. I guess what I would have talked about today was that horrible and crazed video of the 32-year-old Pennsylvania man who beheaded his father and then went to YouTube to tell the world why. I actually watched the whole 14-minute video. Your question for me might be, why, Mike? And I think it was because of the paucity of information in the write-ups of it. They would use a phrase or two, but I wanted to get the full flavor of the insanity. And here's the thing. It's of course disturbing. It's not batshit insane. It's extremely insane, but it is so predictably insane. It's insane as if it went through the insanity plus Tucker Carlson filter. The things that he complains about are exactly and to the phrase what Tucker Carlson talks about on his show most nights. Okay, there was a little bit extra, but he did talk about the column, the fifth column of illegal immigrants. He doesn't want to die in the Russian winter in the war in Ukraine. Tucker's always using those evocative phrases. The traitorous Biden regime. Then he does go on to declare himself president of the United States, and he gives some specific advice to postal workers how they could avoid the upcoming purge. There was one bit of insanity that wasn't exactly pulled from the Tucker playbook. He said that he would have been president already, but for the intervention of 2 of the candidates in 2020. And it was surprising for me. This is not a joke, though it is also not sane. John Hickenlooper and John Kasich, those were the 2 candidates that he shouted out and that were somehow evoked and, stood in the way of this man who is obviously very disturbed, a very disturbed murderer, a very disturbed, insane murderer. Not the Messiah. He does say at one point, I'm not saying I'm the Messiah. I think it was clearly implying he was the Messiah. But that's okay. I watched it. You don't have to. Maybe there is something about the insanity-inducing pounding of construction next door that drove me to literally insanity-filled content. On the show today, and it'll all sound so much better than this, we are doing a full show interview with Lupe Lupin, who I know as someone who tweets at NYC Southpaw. So he's a progressive tweeter, he's a lawyer, and now he's the co-author of a new book called The Truth: Progressives, Centrists, and the Future of the Democratic Party. It pairs well with yesterday's conversation with Josh Green, who wrote about a lot of the same characters, and it pairs well with a Ryan Grimm book called The Squad, about The Squad, that we did a couple of weeks ago. So now that these three books are done and processed, and I feel like I got to know the Democratic Socialists of America, adjacent members of our Congress, I think we can move on. But I give you the last in our trio of Get to Know the Left. This is Lupe Lupin, author of The Truth, Progressive Centrists and the Future of the Democratic Party. Lupe Lupin is a name well known to me, or at least it has been since 2018. I know him from his Twitter, well, formerly Twitter, now X, handle NYC Southpaw. He's a lawyer. He provides consistently caustic leftist takes, but also, you know, he understands the law. And I think it was in 2018 that he wrote an article for Yahoo and he said, you know what? I'm going to come out. I'm going to give my real name. And he told everyone his real name was Lupe Lupin, and people still didn't believe him, but it's all true. He's here to talk about his new book called The Truce, Progressive Centrists and the Future of the Democratic Party. Lupe, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
I have read and interviewed a couple books in a very similar vein to yours. Ryan Grimm was on the show, and the book The Rebels, we talked to author Josh Green on the show. Mm-hmm. And so I was reading your book for What is New. There seem to be a couple of big set pieces. One is, tell me about this. I think this is the first that it's been reported from the Esther Cooper Smith Ballroom, Barack Obama addressing the incoming freshman class of a couple years ago. This is all your scoop?
That's right. So people knew about this event at the time in 2019, right after this is the middle of the Trump administration, the first midterm elections, the Democrats sweep back to power in the House. And as they're getting sort of settled in their offices in the beginning of 2019, Nancy Pelosi actually organizes an event for them at the house of a donor, sort of Kalorama mansion, where Barack Obama comes to speak to them, and they have a behind closed doors session to talk about the future of the party, what these young lawmakers, and it was just the freshmen, the new legislators who are coming to the House, what they're going to do, and how they can sort of guide the trajectory of their own political careers and the party going forward. So it was known at the time that had happened, and I think a few details of the event were reported, but no one knew actually what Obama had said in any detail. And we were able to obtain his remarks. And his talk there, I think, is revealing in that he's talking to the youngest lawmakers, the people who are most in touch with the districts, and trying to think through this problem for them, trying to work with them and encourage them to reach out to young people, reach out to progressives, and bring them into the fold of the party. And I think we also report that some of the most progressive members didn't think he did a really great job in that speech. They were not totally pleased with Obama's presidency, and they weren't totally pleased with his prescriptions for the party going forward. So I think it shows, it's a sort of our first set piece that shows you have progressives, you have this desire to unify the party, and you have centrists. And I think Obama probably was very progressive early in his career, but sort of counts as a centrist as he went through his presidency. And the need for them to come together is the sort of central question of the Democratic Party and whether it's able to wield its majoritarian position and take power, or whether it faces defeats like we saw in 2016. So I keep saying we because I wrote this book with my colleague Hunter Walker.
Yes, and Hunter Walker's last book was The Breach, which was about January 6th, and he was right there and provided a lot of footage or reported, I think, for Rolling Stone at the time. To that point, you're right, a source who worked with the squad said the group of progressive freshmen viewed the session with Obama as a chastising. According to the source, squad members who were able to attend were excited to see Obama. They left the room feeling let down by Obama's remarks, much as they did with his time in office. Well, you're right. Obama is a centrist. He's not going to tell progressives to be more to the left, much more to the left than he is. And I know that's reductive, but he also says, don't be impatient. He also says you have to keep in mind who you're campaigning for. Why would they expect Obama to say something differently? I mean, this worked for him. And in fact, I would go further as to say his appeal to young people was not really on policy grounds. It was on personality grounds.
I think that's That's a fair point. I think that it was, you know, his early on anti-war stances are also were a big part of his campaign in 2008. But I take the squad members' thoughts about Obama as relayed to us by our source to be, you know, also this sort of yearning for a different kind of Obama presidency that we didn't get, that there was the more progressive and ideological possibility early on of the kind of hope and change movement. And that didn't, I think a lot of progressives would say that didn't materialize as much as they hoped it would. And Obama's speech to this group of young lawmakers is fundamentally a pragmatic speech. How do you appeal to young people? How do you get them engaged? How do you at the same time maintain, you know, a political career and not, you know, I think he says at one point, I don't want anyone to go out and light themselves on fire just to do, you know, you have to get reelected. We need you to stay in power and we need you to chart a course that is not self-sacrificing, but one that's directed toward bringing the country to a better place. And self-sacrificing may be the wrong term, not suicidal. And so that tension, I think, you know, is sometimes a disappointing one of pragmatism telling people to temper their ideals and temper their the ability to make real radical structural change.
Yeah. So I'll read from the book. Obama framed the story as an example of how Democrats need to find a balance between progressivism and pragmatism. In his case, he was talking about how don't ask, don't tell eventually won the long game. And he said, I just want to make sure that you heard the point. The key point is you have to be principled. That doesn't mean you have to be absolutist. That doesn't mean you have to be impatient. That doesn't mean you have to be sanctimonious with your fellow Democrats. All right. So I will say I agree with Obama. I think his theory of politics is right. I understand it's not the experience of AOC, Presley, a few of the other members of the squad from their very, very overwhelmingly left-leaning districts. But you tell me why, not just to the ears of progressives, but in reality, Obama got it wrong. Because I think actually he gets it mostly right, even if a few or maybe more than a few progressive members of Congress don't want to hear it.
I think maybe I'm not the best representative to read out the indictment of Barack Obama. I also have a lot of admiration for how he conducts his politics, and I think you can't deny that Obama has been an effective politician, both in office and out of office. And this is what the book is concerned with. You see him focus really in a really determined and I think pragmatic way on sort of stitching together this divide in the party between progressives and centrists that we saw emerge in the 2016 primary with Bernie Sanders on one side and Hillary Clinton on the other. And, you know, the 2020 primary, I think not entirely because of Obama, but in part because of some of his interventions, didn't play out that way. You saw the Democratic Party coalesce behind Biden as a candidate fairly early on. And you saw the Biden campaign actively, and Obama had something to do with this, reach out to the Sanders campaign, include them on these unity commissions that sort of shape the agenda and forged a lot of relationships that carry through into the Biden White House and the more progressive Congress. And that's the story of the first 2 years of the Biden term, is that the Biden White House in a way is more closely connected to the progressives in Congress than to what we term the radical centrists, the sort of cinemas and mansions. And it's the progressives are also its more reliable allies. And they get a lot of legislation passed with that arrangement of Democratic politics. So I think if you look at Obama's record, you have to say he is a very effective politician. He's someone who thinks a lot about these things, thinks deeply, and who uses his influence as far as we can tell in a wise and pragmatic way. And you know, you asked me to sort of state the case against him, and I think the progressive case against him is that he's also someone who is extremely inspiring. He's personally an inspiring leader, and he is able to articulate progressive goals and progressive feelings extremely well, but his pragmatism doesn't, you know, leads him to temper those goals and to make compromises that he sees as pragmatic and necessary, but that, you know, his voters would rather see him, you know, just out there fighting rather than making a compromise. In his view, you've got to, you know, chart a course that is going to lead you to your goal and not simply fight for the sake of fighting.
So tell me, put into your own words or pull from the reporting in your book, the case that the progressive theory of politics is superior. How to get things done in our American political system. I mean, that idea is shot through the book.
Let's say
the book chronicles many people in the Progressive Party. We get into New York politics. There's a lot about members of the squad, a lot about Bernie Sanders. And they have a critique of not just the centrists as exemplified by Manchin and Sinema, who might be something way to the right of centrists. They have a theory of incrementalism, of not swinging for the fences, of not being big or bold or radical enough. They have a theory that the people are really behind this. So I follow politics. I'm like, okay, there's a theory. Let's see when it comes into play if that theory is borne out. I find that more often than not, it is not borne out. And more often than not, the progressive theory of how to get political change is lacking when compared to the more pragmatic approach of you got to get people on board who even you don't agree with. But, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you could, from your reporting, poke holes in my general assessment of how politics actually gets done in the United States.
I think there's a fair point that is absolutely how politics gets done in the United States. And I think that the progressive case is dependent on making structural reforms to the system, that there's a real desire for more, you know, comprehensive change on any number of issues, right? Progressives. And I think a lot of people in politics would love to see comprehensive immigration reform that takes the issue from this sort of high heat, polarizing, racially cathected problem into something more pragmatic. Progressives, I don't think, are super, you know, pie in the sky about immigration. They want the visa system to work well. They want people to be able to legally immigrate to the United States and not have to face 20-year waits. And that requires staffing the agencies and funding them and, you know, spending money to get the immigration system working. And those sorts of things run into the brick wall of the filibuster in Congress, because Republicans, to be frank, want the issue. They prefer to run on immigration. They like immigration to remain a seemingly unsolvable problem, and then to cast all these aspersions on immigrants. It's really hard to do any sort of progressive reform like that, or to do a progressive reform in the healthcare space. To do a Medicare for all, you might have majority support out in the country, but it's never going to get through the Senate. I believe a progressive would tell you that if you get these things done, people were going to experience change in their lives, you know, straight away. I was actually listening to an interview with Pramila Jayapal this morning. She talked to The New Yorker, and she was talking about, you know, how dividing the infrastructure bill from the Build Back Better sort of package of the Build Back Better agenda that Biden tried to get passed was something she'd argued against, because she said that people need to experience change in their lives. And if you pass something like childcare, you know, government support to hire or participate in a childcare program, that changes someone's life, you know, as soon as it's implemented. Whereas if you pass a government program to build a road, if, you know, it may change some people's experience in a way that you hope they notice, but for folks who don't have a job or don't have a house, building that infrastructure isn't going to show them that the progressives and the U.S. government are working on their behalf. And that, I think, is a powerful point.
So a couple of points. One, Build Back Better and those hurdles, those were in filibuster induced. Those were a 50-50 Senate where you just needed Sinema and Manchin on board, and the Democrats couldn't get them. And once they could, then they got the proposals passed. Filibuster did thwart the progressive agenda elsewhere.
You're right.
But I'm thinking about that theory. It seems what Jayapal was articulating really help people materially in their lives. They'll appreciate it. But there seems to be a lot of counter evidence to that right now. I mean, yeah, I know Joe Biden's chip factory is not rolling along, but guess what? He did negotiate drug prices lower. And guess what? He did, you know, cap. He did deliver $35. He is delivering $35 insulin. Seems to be getting no credit for it. So it does seem to me that I would have agreed with Jayapal's ideas before they were passed. But then having seen all these government measures passed and the government not getting credit for the measures, I wonder how true that is.
It's a fair point. And I think there's the other piece of the puzzle here that obviously most folks are very familiar with is that we have a media environment that is, I don't think, structured the way that progressives would exactly like. There's a huge amount of interest in sort of conservative news sources. There's a huge amount of money that goes to conservative news sources. If you have a bad story about immigration, you know it's going to get a lot of clicks and a lot of views, and you know it's going to get picked up on Fox News. And if you have a good story about people not paying as much for their insulin anymore, you know, you might get in the back pages of the New York Times, but you're not going to be seeing that splashed across tabloid covers or you know, talked about on Fox News in the primetime hour. And so it is more difficult for a Democratic administration that has accomplishments to get them in front of people and make them, you know, aware of where this is coming from and why they're seeing this change in their lives. That said, I do think there's some hope that people will come to appreciate these programs as they continue. But I agree with you. I mean, a lot of progressive legislation was passed and the president remains very unpopular. So you have to reckon with that.
The truce is, you mentioned Camilla Jayapal, that comes from her, right? That was her phrase. She was the one who introduced the idea of the truce.
She mentioned it. I'm happy to give her credit for it. We went through several different titles over the course of thinking through this book, and we thought it was the best encapsulation of what we were talking about, that there was this unification of the party that it seems, as you're pointing out, very fragile and tenuous and, you know, open to being ruptured at any point, but that did manage to hold together and put a Democrat in the White House and Democrats in Congress and to put Trump out of office after his first term, which is a significant accomplishment and one that I think deserves to be studied and thought about, and you know, something we've been wrestling with as we've been working on the rollout of this book and trying to think of pieces we can write is like, can it be replicated? Are the challenges of 2024 the same as 2020? They're different. And, you know, Trump obviously isn't in office, and the party with what's going on in the world right now, the party seems like it's sort of in this place where it might split apart again.
So what was the truce between what factions and what were the terms of the truce that got at least, I would say, a significant portion of the progressive agenda passed into law?
The easiest way to think about it is between sort of the Bernie Sanders himself and the people who aligned themselves with Bernie Sanders in 2016 and the early parts of 2020 on one side, and the you know, the successors of Obama and Clinton, who represent sort of a more mainstream vision of Democrats on the other side. And that the what happened over the course of the 2020 primary, we argue, is that you saw a sort of surprising and sudden consolidation among the centrists behind Joe Biden that we think Obama had a lot to do with. After he gained some momentum in South Carolina, you see all these folks dropping in line behind him, dropping out of the race and endorsing Joe Biden. And then once Joe Biden had a commanding position in the primary, you see him reach out to Bernie Sanders and try to do his best to fold Bernie Sanders' campaign into his own, to create these unity commissions I talked about earlier, which sort of wrote the party platform for him and, you know, produced this idea of Build Back Better, which eventually became the legislation called Build Back Better, and also forged a bunch of relationships between people who would be in Congress in the next term and people who would be in the White House. And those relationships and that work, we think, you know, contributed to passing a real raft of progressive legislation in the first 2 years of his term.
We're talking with Lupe Lupin, author of the newly released book, The Truth, Progressives, Centrists, and the Future of the Democratic Party. And we'll be back in a moment to pick up our conversation. Stay tuned. We are back with Lupe Lupin. We're talking about The Truth, Progressive, Centrist, and the Future of the Democratic Party. And here now, in a much nicer sounding way, is the continuation of that conversation. So I want to ask you a question about extending anonymity to sources. I quoted earlier the person with the critique of Obama, a source who worked with the squad. I don't know. That could be anyone. She had a, if we're talking about one of AOC's staffers, some of whom are quoted on the record, many of them either fired or left the campaign after 6 months after a particularly contentious era. You talk about Corbyn, who talks about his addiction to opioids during that time. Later on, we're talking about the Biden campaign. I'll read some of this for my listeners. Worse, the new headquarters were boring. One staffer described walking into the building and thinking about the stale corporate space was exactly what the online left might have imagined for a stuff suit like Biden. When I got there, someone told me that the Biden campaign has the office that Twitter thinks the Biden campaign has, the staffer said. It was just drab. Later on, anonymity is extended to, there was another dire omen. On caucus night, the campaign ordered Mexican. When they saw District Taco in the office, one campaign operative said, people thought it was going bad. It was literally one of the most depressing nights of my life, the operative continued. Why extend anonymity for people to criticize the catering at a campaign staff event?
I think the... It's always tough talking about sourcing decisions because you don't want to say more than you've said in the written work. But I think
you wouldn't want to expose them,
right? And I think you're the painting of a picture of the Biden campaign in those early days we thought was important to explain how sort of ramshackle the operation was to begin with, how the staffers who were working there felt a little bit cursed in the early days of the Biden campaign. They didn't have the sense of this juggernaut that was going to sweep to the White House once the plan was fully executed. And we thought that was an important story to bring. And, when you do use an anonymous source, you are asking the reader to trust you. Your judgment that the source has the authority to speak on the subject they're speaking about and that the subject they're speaking about is important enough. And, I think you can take some of what we did there as a little bit lighthearted, but I think it makes a serious point, which is that the Biden operation early on didn't have this feeling of the future president. It was very much on a shoestring like any other campaign. And they managed to put together a winning campaign from that beginning. And that to me is an important data point that it wasn't, I think often we think about presidents and successful politicians as being these commanding figures all the way throughout who have the right strategy and the right vision coming forward. And I want to hasten to add that we confirmed all those details, I believe on the record with Greg Schultz, the campaign manager, who speaks later in that chapter. And
well, not all the details. This person alleged that the water in the office wasn't potable. They didn't pay for a water cooler. And Greg Schultz dismissed the complaint about the water out of hand. I drank the water every single day. It was fine. I have to tell you, as I was reading that, I was like, without knowing who this staffer was, and staffer can mean anything, right? Technically, volunteers or staffer. It could just be anyone who was there for 3 weeks and never liked Biden to begin with. Or I guess it could be an important person who we should pay attention to. And there are a lot of anonymous sources. I find it very hard as a news reader to be able to fully evaluate the legitimacy of a complaint if I don't know who the source is, if I don't know what their motivations or what their status might be. And there was a lot of anonymity for what I thought of as backbiting against centrists or moderates in this book.
Well, you know, I hear your criticism, and I think all I can do is assure you that wasn't our intention I think what you're seeing there is an effect of trying to understand details about a campaign for people who are currently in power. So Biden is the president, Kamala Harris is the vice president. It is very difficult to get folks on the record to speak about them at all. We spent weeks and weeks with Harris's team working to try to get someone on the record to say positive things about her. And that was a challenge we didn't really meet. The background quotes around a president are something, you know, we tried to break through. We obviously prefer to put everyone on the record and use their name. And we tried that with everyone we spoke with. But sometimes, you know, you do the best that you can to present the picture of what's really happening. And we tried not to put gratuitous information in, but we thought that there were important to paint a picture of the Biden campaign in those early days.
So the Harris quote, and the Guardian has excerpted this, and the quote from the anonymous staffer, but in this case, the person is described as a senior staffer, is the headline of this piece. This person should not be president. Kamala Harris takes hit in book on Biden. I read the chapter, but why don't you tell the audience what the complaint of her staff was? Why were senior members of her staff coming to the conclusion that she's not fit for the presidency?
And I want to underline, these are people who signed on to her campaign who were, at least at one point supportive of Kamala Harris to become the president, and who through the course of their experience in that campaign, came to the opposite conclusion. There's no doubt that that person would be described as a disgruntled staffer, right? But their critique was not about personal stuff. It was about the way the campaign lacked direction and the difficulty in framing a principled position that the campaign could stick to. And that is something that we saw in her campaign and her in the vice president's office and the people we talked to, and we thought it was important to report.
How many members of a campaign staff would be defined as a senior staffer approximately?
I think it would depend on the campaign, but you can... we're not talking about volunteers or interns here, I promise you.
Okay. Last question. Do you think, this is your prognostication question, the theory is that to get, and this is where the book started, our interview started, how to get young people impassioned. The theory is more progressive policies will get young people impassioned. And if young people aren't impassioned, if young people are blasé about an election, they'll sit it out and the Democrats will lose. The counter theory is that, yeah, but Donald Trump. How do you think it's going to play out?
I think this election shares a lot of, as a general election, and I'm taking this sort of assumption that Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee, and I think it's pretty clear Joe Biden's going to be the Democratic nominee, that in a rematch election, I think there's a couple advantages for Biden. One is that he's now the incumbent president of the United States, and that gives people some reassurance about him, his ability to do the job. And I think the, you know, Trump's sort of career through the courts since he's left office isn't going to win him many voters. And so all those things, I think, go in Biden's column. It's a rematch. He won the last one. He's an incumbent now. Trump's had a lot of legal troubles. And I think a lot of what Trump has said is, to the extent people focus on it and take it seriously, is, you know, scary stuff about, you know, the president having absolute immunity, and his lawyers say that means he could assassinate his rivals, and if you get a bad apple, there's nothing you can do about it. That kind of stuff is, I think, troubling to voters. So totting all that up in Biden's column, I think he's got a decent chance. But I think Trump, as we've talked about, has more command in the media, more ability to bring eyeballs to himself, and people are obviously still fascinated by him as a politician and a character in their lives. And he obviously has a very devoted following. It's not, you know, it's not a majority of the country, but it is a sizable percentage of the country, and they're extremely devoted to him and adore him. So I think there's, like 2020, I think it's going to be a close race. If I have to offer a prognostication, I don't think it will be materially too different from what we saw in 2020, which was a real nail biter, and one where either candidate could win until the very last day.
Right. It all came down to the bamboo in the ballots and the Italian satellites. The name of the book is the name of the book is The Truce, Progressive Centrist and the Future of the Democratic Party, co-written with Hunter Walker. We've been speaking with Lupe B. Lupin. You should check out his Substack, Paw Prints, and he tweets or X's at NYC Southpaw. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Mike. I appreciate you. And thank you for reading the book. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
I hope you liked some of it.
That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara. The senior producer is Joel Patterson. Michelle Pesca is CLO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperu, gperu, duperu, and thanks for listening.